Imagine. He's 1880, and Thomas Edison is 33 years old, having just developed a company that would deliver the electricity to power and light the cities of the world. He had also invented a phonograph, recording sound, and was yet to invent the motion picture. He is deaf. At this exact same moment, at the Second International Congress on Education of the Deaf in Milan, 164 hearing delegates are deciding the future of deaf people and their language, ruling oral education superior to manual education, to restoring the deaf-mute to society. Those who vote and all learning materials are carefully selected in supporting and promoting the use of oralism. Speech therapy is enforced, and separation is suggested as being the cure for genetic deafness. This encouraged a ban on deaf people signing, marrying, and having children together, resulting in many of them being confined to spend the rest of their futures being physically and psychologically punished for not conforming to these ideals. Imagine again, an entire history of visual language being wiped out. Your child in a deaf family, with previous access to education, language, and social interactions, and suddenly you can't attend your school because it's closed. You can't use your language without being beaten. Your family are watched and punished. You will grow up not being allowed to love another deaf person. You will probably be sterilised to prevent breeding undesirable ethical elements, and all of your focus will be on how to be accepted into society by the sound of your voice, regardless of whether you understand what anyone says. Then imagine again, exactly 100 years later, there follows a few months of struggles when instinct tells the mother her child isn't quite responding like her previous children. Those instincts are consistently debated with medical professionals who then announce, "I'm so sorry, your daughter is deaf. Do not socialise her with other deaf people. Teach her to speak and integrate her into society. Lip reading and speech therapy will serve you well. And never use sign language." That child was me. I was deprived of language and access to understanding that led me to not speak for the first 7 years of my life. I then struggled in speech therapy and audiology sessions where I consistently failed tests. Set up to consistently fail its participants. I was bullied and isolated. I became reclusive and obese. I couldn't be comforted when I fell over. I couldn't articulate what was happening when I was abused. I didn't feel completely connected to friends and missed out on playground conversations, classroom activities, and family gatherings. My best friends were animals and food. I learnt to speak and was always congratulated on it, like it was my biggest achievement that they could understand me. I grew up with no self-worth, but at least I spoke well. When thinking about communication, it feels contextual, episodic and sporadic as memory. They appear as triggers and anchors, as if coming face to face with a volatile relationship. With age and art comes a kind of self-assuredness, journeying into reflection and realisation. This series of words acts as a series of memories, and I ask that you hold my hand for a while as we travel through the past, present, and possible futures, not just to listen, but to see. I jump ahead to my teen years and remember how people would hammer at the window of our school bus when taking trips into town, making groaning noises and banging their wrists together and yelling, "Spastics!" to a chorus of Flipped Birdie from inside. I thought I was protecting my friends from attacks by telling them not to sign in public, but without realising, I too was teaching them to feel ashamed and preserving the status quo. After a childhood of language deprivation, being failed by mainstream schools and held back from belonging somewhere, I was angry. And yet, I discovered becoming a teenager comes with resistance, rebellion, and believed invincibility. This was the beginning of the end of shame. At weekends, we released those frustrations by being as boundless and fired up as possible, breaking every rule we could. Underage clubbing, drugs, binge drinking, promiscuous sex. The louder the location, the better. Because then everyone was deafened, so nobody bothered having conversations and just danced or found an alleyway for mischief. This was the height of Ladette culture and rave. People were angry and frustrated with the state of the country, but found a way to get lost and get high. Anything went, and some of us went with it. 1996, I'm in a photo booth, sitting on my mate's lap. We're grinning inanely, giddy with the heat of a shot of vodka still travelling in our chests. Flushed cheeks and poked ribs waiting for the flashes that will hold our youth in the palms of our hands forever. Daniel and I were in our prime. Attractive, mischievous and untouchable. We opened the curtains of our boxed moment of joy to a horde of hands and faces alive with animated expression and liberty. These were our mates, nearly 100 of us, and the police. There was concern for this mass group of young people, slightly drunk and seemingly aggressive, who they couldn't understand. Fueled by Dutch courage and teenage arrogance, the frustration of too long-held resilience erupted into a flurry of angry words carved into air. A director I once worked with remarked recently that he remembers waiting for a train at Waterloo Station in the 90s and seeing a silent riot happening between deaf kids and the police. That it fascinated him seeing and yet not hearing that anger. We laughed at the realisation that I was among them. What he didn't know is that we'd come from 5 years of systematic, regimented oralism at our boarding school, where for those whose family's first language was British Sign Language, would be hit into submission, given detention, made to stand in corners and denied adventures or even trips home, because their first language is deemed a rebellious act and should be punished. There's a particular violence in that. And this was less than 25 years ago. The effect of that still lingers today. But these kids were the very kids that gave me identity, belonging, a language that let me in. Witnessing their pain stayed with me. So at school, we'd behave. Then, every weekend, we'd queue up at the Astoria GAY Club in Soho and pay with gay by kissing our best mates so we'd be let into a world where we wouldn't be judged, attacked or policed. Buzzing on poppers and Kylie Minogue, we were free. It wasn't just London. We'd hide in luggage racks, under coats and in train toilets to travel on one ticket between six of us to Wolverhampton, Sheffield, Liverpool and huge Blackpool rallies where thousands of deaf people would gather for an almighty piss-up. Fights with the police were notorious, but in more recent years this became a rarity. Why? Because the local police learnt to sign. The power of communication. With these gatherings, it wasn't about safety in numbers. It was about empowerment. It was visibility. And for all the years, we've been told we won't matter to the world unless we could say our T's. We mattered to each other. We swapped the beeps and hums of hearing tests for the heavy bass and thrums of nightclubs. We walked out of solitary confinement and into community centres and deaf clubs. We said goodbye to integration and hello to voluntary segregation in retaliation and reclamation. We were wild and hungry. We were the lucky few who could afford to be reckless because we were given a good education. It wasn't good because it was via speech. It was good because it was good teaching made accessible. Accessibility is more powerful than knowledge alone. Over 90% of deaf children are raised in hearing families. Had all those deaf babies been given access to communication and language, who knows what else they could have become? Had those mainstream deaf kids been able to fully access banter in the playground, as well as the complex lessons, they'd be given therapy as adults rather than seeking it. But instead, as a 100-year hangover from that Milan conference, there ended up being so many displaced deaf people desperately seeking to belong, where there'd be the relief and liberty of being able to just be a kid, then a teenager, then an adult, who mucked about, worked hard, dreamed large, fell in love, had sex, became parents, painters, performers, professionals, people with names. What if they weren't withheld from that? What if they were always allowed in? From the very beginning, we're taught that speech equals intelligence. More attention and opportunity is given to those of us who sound hearing. The mocking around deaf voice forced many deaf people to stop speaking entirely, speaking being the very thing that was encouraged, believing it to be attainable for every deaf person and the only key to doors opening for you in life. Yet it was a lie that divided the community into hierarchies of small D deaf with good speech and big D deaf, fluent in BSL and culturally rich, creating a rift between survivors. This is what has been done to us, divide and conquer. What it also did was leave those in the middle, a far greater majority who didn't fit in either world, no access or belonging. Throughout these years at school, I secretly picked up sign language and formed a community and identity. And with this, I felt untouchable. But I hadn't yet acknowledged the privilege I had. My speech. Congratulated on how normal I sounded, how clever that made me, how I wasn't like those deaf people, formed internalised autism, a word created for the oppressive attitudes surrounding deafness and its negative connotations. I hated myself because I wasn't good enough, but then was taught to think I was better than those who didn't use speech. Full of both shame and superiority, I was poisoning myself. Not fitting in either world, so I fitted nowhere. Everything changed when I changed, when I accepted and embraced who I was, and learnt and listened to the community, and in turn understood myself better, replacing what I was taught with what was right and just and true. In listening, I discovered oppression, rage, protectiveness, fear, resilience, joy, and love, complex, complex love. And from that community, I found my most authentic self. It was withheld from me, from us, but like nature that grows through pavement cracks, it found a way. Looking back, my first taste of physical and visual language was the language of theatre, an expressive form that allowed me to connect before I had words, and it never left me. Often these two sides of me unite, acting and sign language, and often that's when the work I create is most celebrated. Isn't it strange, then, that after all these years of resistance from society, that same society so desperately wants to drink up and elevate our language and culture, the very thing they feared?